Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quinn Kesnick, and it is Friday. We are previewing what, to some minds, is the first weekend of the college lacrosse season. To others, is the second. And Quinn, it's great to have you back.
Great to be back. Excited about our week one podcast. Thanks, folks, for listening. Pass it on to your friends. Hope everyone enjoyed it, and excited to get this month of February going for real now.
Well, let's look back at the week that was, because you and I both had some pretty cool experiences, and we'll start with the more recent. That is that you called the first game of the season on ESPNU at Homewood Field. You were doing the play-by-play. You were on the mic, and you were complimented by your man, Paul Carcaterra. And before we dive into the game in which Johns Hopkins emerged victorious over Navy, I want to talk a little bit about the broadcast. This was a cool experience for you, a little bit poignant in the wake of the news that Eamon McEnany will not be rejoining the team for the 2017 season. What was it like for you to call that game?
Well, I think last year I did one game play-by-play. I like it. It's a great form of cross-training for me. You know, it's like when I was in college, I never played goalie during the summer. I always played midfield. And so when you're in the play-by-play role, one thing you have to do is you have to prepare really hard. I mean, you got to grind. And so I grinded all week. And then, you know, my relationship with Kark is so strong and our chemistry is so good that I don't have to worry about that. But it's a different role, and I know I grow from it because there's some strain involved. There's some uncomfortableness, you know, and without strain and without being uncomfortable, you don't grow. You don't get better. So I know I'll be a better analyst for that experience. Doing play-by-play on the 18th, again, Georgetown-Notre Dame. I came from Frisco, Texas, Dallas, the home of the Cowboys practice facility. Amazing place. So I'm excited about that, and I think I'm going to do play-by-play one more time during the season for a women's game, Stony Brook at Johns Hopkins. So, you know, a couple of those every year keeps me on edge, and I thought it was a positive experience. You know, I look back, I thought I had a decent game. I screwed up Jack Raypine's high school, you know, Upper Dublin. I had Ohio on my mind. For some reason, I thought Dublin was in Ohio. And then, he and Trevor Kelsch, I kind of flip-flopped. You know, Kelsch is from Yorktown, the senior, and Raypine, the talented freshman. But Upper Dublin's in PA, not Ohio. And some fans made that clear to me. And like my goaltending days, you have a great game, but it's the one you messed up that sits with you. So, you know, like I vow not to let that happen on the 18th when Georgetown plays Notre Dame. Make 10 saves, you let in that one goal, and you go back to practice on Monday, and your focus is on fixing that one goal that went in.
Always getting better, my man. So let's dive into the action on the field, because I think this was a game that satisfied folks of both mindsets. Those that thought, you know, I think that there were some folks who were really, really high on Johns Hopkins coming into this season, deviated from the mean in that way. And certainly the fourth quarter, you know, bore that out. But for the first roughly three quarters, this was nip and tuck, and this was the matchup of a Johns Hopkins team that had a disappointing end to their 2016 season, facing off against a Navy team that had a lot of optimism coming away from a quarterfinal run. Ultimately, I want to throw out a couple of my reactions to why I felt like Johns Hopkins performed so strong and see what your thoughts are. And first, go ahead.
No, you go.
Just got to start with the fact they put up 15 goals. And to me, you know, I felt like the people have rightly pointed out the depth and how many pieces Coach Bobby Benson can throw at opposing defenses. But for me, it started with Joel Tinney and Connor Reed and their explosiveness, because that was the biggest question mark. Were they going to immediately hit the field with game-level speed? And even though Tinney had 3-2 and Reed didn't have the statistical performance that measured up in that respect, I thought that there were a couple of dodges where he showed some explosive pop. And what's interesting about Connor Reed's career is that he's managed to remain a threat despite being, you know, a 20 to 30 point a season type guy. And so for me, you know, that showed that they had the seeds of being able to make defenses spin that they didn't have last year. And then, you know, just kind of looking at the other end of the field, I thought that all around the field, the defensive performances were pretty strong, but I think for me, it starts and stops with Nick Fields. I thought that was the best game that he's played in his career. His ability to utilize his size and strength in matching up against Jack Gray. And then more than that, it was his ability to creatively get the ball off the ground. There was one instance in which he goofed the ball into the crease and Gerald Logan was able to come up and create an easy clear. And then another goal or another ground ball toward the corner. You know, those are really difficult ground balls for a lot of defensemen, particularly that aren't totally confident in their stick, to dig out and move. And he was able to do that. And I thought that that was a really promising sign for a Johns Hopkins team that is going to have to rely on its leadership at the defensive end of the field in many instances, particularly in the wake of Ryan Brown's graduation.
I have four takeaways for Hopkins. I mean, we could go over this individually. I have question marks, as does their coaching staff. Well, first of all, the strength of the Wolf is in the pack. And when you play 27 guys through three quarters, you can wear teams down. You're going to have great practices coming back to next week when so many guys are in the mix. And I think that's a great thing right now if you're a Blue Jay fan. Third attack spot, still up for grabs. I think it'll remain a carousel of guys, whether it's Cole Williams, Kyle Maher, Forey Smith, or Jake Fox. Shaq Stanwyck played okay. You know, his game is his game. He's not going to back an elite defender to the end line and blow by him and score goals. But in transition on extra man, he's going to find the open guy. Midfield, I really liked what I saw. When you can roll nine guys out there, somebody's going to have a good day. And it's just a matter of finding the right combinations. I do think that Connor Reed is not anywhere near 100% right now. Wearing that knee brace, he didn't look like he was his usual self. I thought Drew Sapinski was also a little rusty and a step slow. I was impressed with what I saw from Alex Pincannon. He's got a little quicks. He looks to be healthy, as does Kieran Eisler. But Tinney was the star of the midfield. You know, just his ability to seize the moment, his ability to compete. He's such a gamer. They just have to watch the way they're rationing his energy, because he's playing on the wings of faceoffs. He's playing a lot of defense. So that's something that bears watching. I thought John Crawley, now he's going to split time between attack and midfield. He's the proven commodity, captain, great attitude, enthusiasm. He's a leader. He plays with charisma now. He's got 52 career goals. So that was my take on the midfield. The shorties, I still think, are not tier one shorties. While they played okay, Carlini, Bruno, Hubler, Lane Odom, Daniel Jones, they made some plays. They're a little smallish and undersized, and I worry about those guys against some of the more athletic squads that Hopkins will face down the road. Craig Medeiros, nice job facing off against their very, very tough Brady Dove. I mean, those guys are both veterans. They've battled and battled. Right now, the Jays kind of missing Hunter Moreland as a number two punch. He's hurt after a 59% season a year ago. So that's an area of vulnerability. Medeiros has got to stay healthy. And then defensively, the third spot, you know, Ray Pine, the freshman out of Upper Dublin, PA, man, that kid is an athlete. Very impressed with what I saw there. I thought Nick Fields continues to get better and better now as a senior. As you said, he was active. He was causing havoc. He was flying around. He's got great foot speed, and now he's starting to put that to work. You know, he's more impact on the ground, more impact in double teams. It was a big positive step for him. So that third defensive spot is got to be looked at. And then the goalie's position I thought was very, very solid. Jerry Logan looked good. He looked comfortable. He looked confident. Clearing was above par for the Blue Jays, and that was an issue last year that did not hurt them against Navy.
Well, so speaking of Navy, you know, the offense seemed like it was going to start with the ball in Jack Gray's stick, and that isn't necessarily a huge surprise, but at the same time, coming away from the Casey Reese injury, there were certainly some questions there, and I think that was one of the reactions that I saw a lot throughout social media and other places on the internet, was people kind of realizing, like, oh, wow, we do have some needs in term and a lack of experience at the offensive end. What did you take away from Navy's performance?
Yeah, Ryan Wade, you know, really making his first start as the quarterback. He's a good passer, four assists. He got the vision. Liked what I saw there. Jack Ray, you know, while his skill set may be limited, he's still 6'6", 261. When he gets going downhill, look out. He can hit the mid-range, the outside shot. He looked really good. The third attack spot, they need to get more production. And then midfield-wise, Grayson Terrain now, as he draws the pole with Casey Reese being hurt, you know, he's going to have to pick his spots, and he too logged a lot of miles, wings of faceoffs, little defense, you know. So it's going to be a tough season for him because he's going to get so much attention. He does have that quick first step, but Hopkins sent an immediate double team to number six. Colin Flownlacker, I like his game. I think he's going to have a solid season. And then from that third spot, they need more production. So to me, their fifth and sixth offensive options didn't do enough. And the second midfield really had no impact. I think you got some nice athletes on that second midfield, guys like Ray Wardell or Ian Burgoyne, but there just wasn't much offense there. Navy's going to have to look at the way they're playing O in settled sets and maybe go to a little more picks, two-man games, because I'm not seeing the amount of Dodgers. I think that's, you know, they don't have Dodgers to put them in a quarterfinal NCAA tournament game.
It felt like they really went to the well on that Grayson Terrain invert a lot. Do you think that's sustainable throughout the season?
Well, you got Terrain, and then you draw the eyes of the defense and draw some doubles. I'd love to see him kick it to Wade then, and then have Wade pick apart the D. You know, who are your shooters outside of Jack Ray and maybe Flownlacker? Again, I think that's a work in progress. I like the idea. Terrain's so quick back there. He puts pressure on the D, and he's going to draw a double. Just a matter of the other guys being in the right spots to capitalize.
Anything from the defensive end of the field? That was certainly the area in which the team was built last year.
Yeah, I don't think you can underestimate the injury to DJ Plumer. And they're hoping to get him back maybe as soon as Saturday against Maryland. You know, he's a great short stick defensive midfielder. And so he and Trainer form a wonderful 1-2 punch, and you bring in David Jones. So that was a position of strength that all of a sudden Trainer had to run every shift. And while he's a tone setter, he's a blue-collar guy, he stirs the Navy drink as the captain wearing number 40. A little pressure on him, and that caused him to move Hiram Carter, who can play close, he can play pole, and he played short stick defensive mid the other day. And man, he got taken to the rack a lot. He had a busy day. So the defense with Plumer doesn't look the same. Chris Fennell, their captain down low, great player. I thought he played well. I thought he won the matchup against Stanwyck, and then you look at the score sheet. That was not indicative of his abilities as a defender. And then had Michael Strack and Stephen Hinks, you know, two new faces, two guys. I think Navy's defense will be okay when they get Plumer back.
What do you think of the hidden ball trick phenomenon and how viral those tend to go?
Well, I think there's a bunch of factors. You know, the one camera angle was strong. You could see both the flip. You could see the goal. And so that was like a perfect scenario for us and for me to call that play. It wasn't like, you know, that's a dangerous time in the game because we can start storytelling there. You're assuming the team's going to be subbing. You can really go off the tracks there if you're not focused. And we were lucky that it was right in front of the substitution box. I mean, I could reach out and grab the ball from Joel Tinney. And then the game's played on a Tuesday with you know, not much else going on, I don't think, you know, other than a little college basketball. So it got great legs on the internet, and people were able to see it, and I think it was a good start. And I feel that from the TV standpoint, we had great momentum at the end of 2016. That the NCAA tournament from top to bottom was outstanding. Our championship game was unbelievable, and now we just take that momentum. And my goal is just to run with it, and a play like that gets us off to a wonderful start.
Last thing before we move on from Hopkins Navy is that this is a game that has special poignancy for you, given your family connections. Obviously, you are a Johns Hopkins alum, but you know, maybe not everybody knows how closely related you are to the Naval Academy. So, what's it like to call this rivalry, and you know, particularly from the lens of thinking back on how impactful it's been, you know, dating all the way back to your high school days?
Yeah, you know, Tuesday was pretty emotional for me in that, you know, the Bob Scott statue's there for the first time. We dove into that. My older brother went to Navy, and I was in fifth through eighth grade. I was the biggest Navy lacrosse fan on the planet. My heroes were his teammates. One of them in particular, Bob Bianchi, who graduated in 1983. He eventually lost his life in a helicopter accident while serving our country. And you know, their MVP award is the Bob Bianchi Award. I remember going to games and afterwards, you know, Bobby would have a catch with me, and, you know, he was my hero. So you know, when I go to a Navy game, it's special. You know, that was always the biggest rivalry for me, because had I been, you know, had early recruiting been around when I was in ninth grade, there's no doubt in my mind, 100%, that I would have signed on the dotted line at Thorvald to go to Navy in ninth grade.
It's a really interesting opportunity. It's a really interesting thing to reflect on. And for me, you know, I had a similar type of experience. I made the decision that I needed to be at Cleveland State's inaugural game. So last Saturday, they hosted the University of Michigan on Krenzler Field at the corner of East 18th and let's see, I should know this, but I don't. I want to say it's Euclid. Either way, myself and Jackie Borowski, you know, hopped in the car on Saturday morning, made great time out there, heading west on Interstate 76. And I got to say, the thing that was so unique for me is, and Quinn, I think you can relate to this, you know, growing up on Long Island, I have to imagine that when you guys, when the Kesnick family decided that they were going to go check out a Hofstra game, more likely than not, you were going to see some of your Lynbrook teammates or coaches at the game, and it was a community-based event, meaning that, you know, for all the folks that were in attendance, they were the types of kids that you were practicing against or playing against over the course of the week during the season. You know, and for me, playing high school across in Northeast Ohio, I didn't have that experience. Our touch points were our games, and that was it. There was no, you know, additional opportunity to engage with the lacrosse community aside from when we picked up our sticks and hit the field. And so, you know, 14 years after playing my last high school lacrosse game, you know, I step into the doors of Cleveland State's first varsity game, and one of the first people I see was my high school lacrosse coach. And it was incredibly poignant and really exciting. And I think that, you know, I've got to give a tremendous amount of credit to the folks who made it happen, because when people think about the idea of Division I expansion in men's lacrosse, which is something that, you know, I've followed closely over the course of my career at Inside Lacrosse and care deeply about, because I feel how important it is for the growth of the sport overall and the continued enrichment of the experiences that young lacrosse players can have. Most folks didn't think about Cleveland State, you know, a state school in Northeast Ohio that doesn't fit the profile of most lacrosse playing Division I schools. But John Perry is the athletic director. He's outgoing. We talked about him last week, and, you know, he grabbed the bull by the horns and, you know, by fortune of fate, brought in one of the few Northeast Ohio natives that was able to coach at this level, and they're off and running. And I think that, you know, my takeaway from the game and the personnel on the field was that they were incredibly skilled for a first-year program, and they had impressive mental toughness to battle back from falling behind 6-1 after scoring the first goal of the game. They played a Michigan team that clearly has pieces that the program hasn't had in its previous five seasons in terms of big, you know, strong, developed, experienced midfielders and some defensive personnel that were able to make plays with some consistency. But that being said, Cleveland State took advantage of what I think has been Michigan's biggest weakness in the entirety of the existence of the program, and that is an inability to be consistent. And so when there were those moments when Michigan's focus waned a little bit in the middle of the second quarter and late in the game, Cleveland State was able to take advantage and produce what I think was a very respectable final score in coming away with a 13-8 loss in their first game. You know, certainly the task does not get any easier as they head to Duke this week, but I think that that's the idea. They are not in a league, and they are not playing for an NCAA tournament spot in year one. So as a result, they're playing to show this roster what Division I lacrosse is all about, what the standards that need to be met are. And once you get both the experience at the highest levels, as well as, we talked about this last week, the opportunity to play some local Division II and Division III programs with whom they will be more competitive and more likely than not favored in those matchups, then you're able to come away with both ends of the spectrum and say, we know we're good enough to win games against certain levels of competition. Now we just need to get better. And for me, it was a really special experience to be able to be a part of that. And the last thing I'll say is, man, it is so nice to be able to watch a lacrosse game played indoors in early February. Wow, it is beautiful to be in 65-degree weather.
Well, I thought your piece was an A+. The article you wrote about the experience, and I thought Jacqueline, she does amazing work with her camera. And if you haven't seen it, go to insidethecross.com and you find that article with a lot of the pictures, because you guys captured what that day meant. You know, these programs, we just think it's, We just think it's another Division I program. But when they put their flag in the ground, the impact in the local community, whether it be Marquette, Richmond, Denver, maybe Utah one day, there's a lot of high schools, youth leagues that benefit. And it really is that they become the local franchise, and the trickle down is enormous. And so hopefully that'll be the case in Cleveland.
Well, let's move on to some of the other things, talking points in this in this week of college lacrosse. Certainly, we hope that you listen to Kyle Devin and Dan Abram unpack the week in an immediate way on Monday, and then Mark Dixon and Dan Flynn take some deep dives in the middle week. But you know, as we turn our attention to this week ahead, we're going to take a look back at some of the injuries and player situations that came to the forefront in the first weekend of college lacrosse action. And you know, we'll start with a preseason All-American in Vermont midfielder Ian McKay. Vermont went to Furman and Mercer, pulled out a statistical anomaly in a pair of come-from-behind wins, resulting in 13-12 overtime victories under first-year coach Chris Fifes. And they did it without the presence of McKay. My colleague Matt Kinnear reached out inquiring about McKay's status. He was held out due to injury. The injury was unspecified. However, there was confirmation that hope is he will be back for Vermont's next game, which is on February 18th, as he continues to be evaluated by medical personnel. This was a little bit of a surprise for me because there was a lot of conversation about McKay, particularly on social media. He took over Lax Film Room Snapchat leading up to the game, and then to not see him on the field was a little bit of a head-scratcher, and particularly after two games. But certainly a tip of the cap to the Catamounts as they were able to overcome his absence and start 2-0.
Yeah, two wins on the road down south against teams who have a weather advantage in a three-day period, both nail-biters. And if you saw any of the clips, you had some really eye-opening, eye-catching, wonderful playmaking in terms of some assists, Cam Milligan and that bunch. You know, congratulations to Chris Fifes. I've always liked him a lot, former Maryland player, instrumental at North Carolina, getting them a national championship for the first time since 1991. I thought you guys had Vermont rated a little too low at 45. I think I wrote about that. That's a team that's going to challenge in the America East. They should be somewhere in the 25 to 30 range.
One of the burgeoning upsets throughout the day on Saturday, it looked like it was going to happen, was Providence over BU. The Friars hosting the Terriers in their first game of the season. And a surprise absence in this one was faceoff man Sam Talco, best known as one of the offense from the dot draw takers in college lacrosse. The Terriers were able to come back largely on the strength of a 16-save performance out of Christian Carson Bannister in net for BU. Our Kyle Devitt inquired after the game and was informed that Talco was held out due to an accumulation of small injuries and is expected that he will be a part of BU's next game.
Yeah, BU opens up with four straight on the road. It's a team that I thought has upward trajectory written all over them. You know, they kind of hit a wall at the end of last year, and they lost their last five games. But when they get Sam back facing off, he's nearly a 70% guy. That's a big, big deal. You can't underscore his importance to that team.
Moving on, another surprising absence was in Columbus, Ohio, as the Buckeyes hosted Furman on Sunday, pulled out a 12-6 victory without the presence of senior attackman Eric Fennell, who was the story of the fall as he had an incredible performance, either five or six goals against North Carolina in the annual Michael Bresci scrimmage. As a result, it was a relatively young lineup at attack for the Buckeyes, with Colin Chell being the only veteran who had had a significant amount of experience. You know, Fennell was a junior transfer from a Division III school in Michigan who suffered from some injury issues last season. Inquired about his status, he was not held out due to injury and is expected to play in the Buckeyes' next game versus Detroit.
I watched him practice, as we talked about last week. I did not go over jersey numbers or do, you know, detailed inventory, so my bad there. But I just wanted to enjoy practice and watch Coach and that team work. Ohio State's going to have an interesting little deal here now. Look at their schedule. They've softened it up a bit out of conference and early initially. You know, Furman, Detroit, UMass, Jacksonville, Marquette, Bellarmine, Cleveland State. They could win all those games. There's no question that the Buckeyes could open this season 7-0. That Marquette game looms large. That's going to be played in Milwaukee as part of the Midwest Classic. And then they come back 2 days later and play Bellarmine. But, you know, UMass on the 18th is a good test for them as well. But, you know, Buckeyes, when they're playing indoors, undefeated now. What are they, something like 18 or 19-0 all time playing at Woody Hayes? And guess where that UMass game is going to be played?
I didn't know that. That's an incredible anomaly.
They've never lost a game in Woody Hayes, and it's approaching 20 all time. So, regardless of the weather, on February 18th, that UMass game has been signed off as a game that will be played indoors. Big advantage.
I want to talk about that, and it's a nice transition into the next game. And the thing about Woody that's unique is that the windows up high and that strip of light on the field, and the reason it parlays into our next game, because we'll talk about Air Force's 11-10 win over Duke. And one of the things that I found interesting that was pointed out to me is that Duke goalie Danny Fowler made only one stop in, I believe it was the second and fourth quarters, when he was facing the setting sun there in Koskinen Stadium. Another one of those types of anomalies that if it hadn't been pointed out to me, I wouldn't have known. But the reason I want to talk about this game is those who watched it saw Joey Manon leave the field with a nick after he was playing a ground ball on the end line. I wasn't certain whether he came back in. We reached out. The Duke Athletic Communications staff informed us that he is a full go in practice this week and will be available for the High Point game on Friday. So that's good news, particularly for a Duke offense that debuted a lot of personnel in this loss to the Falcons.
You guys had Duke at 8. I debuted them at 16. They're probably unlikely to be in my top 20 when folks can read that on Monday the 13th. But you know, a lot of new talented freshman class by Duke, absolutely. But I'm not sure a freshman class is worth much in that conference. And it's a typically slow starting Duke team, ambushed once again from Air Force, and I underestimated Air Force. I did not have them in the top 20. I thought they lost too much. You go back to last year; they were 8-1 in close games. Well, guess what? They won another close game, and Coach Danowski even referenced that in his post game comments. He said, you know, they've got some players who now have learned to win those games, to make those critical plays, and they did it once again. So, tip of the cap to Eric Saramet and the Falcons, who suddenly now are like a national program who we got to consider as a top 20 team year in and year out.
I wrote about the SoCon team's best and worst case scenarios for InsideLacrosse.com on Thursday, and my takeaway is that it's a three-horse race for the number one seed, the way it was last year, and a manifestation of the way that it was a two-horse race prior to Air Force's arrival. But I think that what's so interesting about the SoCon is there's a lot of competition. Really, you know, if you include Furman, there are four teams competing for that fourth spot in the conference tournament. I think that Bellarmine is the incumbent. Mercer was probably on paper the best team each of the last two seasons. Jacksonville certainly has a lot of buzz with the new coaching staff. And then, like we mentioned, you know, Furman put in an equal performance as the Bears did against Vermont. So, you know, that indicates that they shouldn't fall too far behind. Yeah.
Yeah, Furman's definitely getting better. You know, I caught part of that game on the live feed, and they're better than they were last year. They just got to learn to win some close games. You know, I remember last year early on they lost to Ohio State by one. You know, this was another case where they had that game. They just got to learn to finish. They're so close. And once they get that confidence, look out. That league, the SoCon overall, has amazed me with how quickly that these programs ramped up. The Richmond's in the High Point of the world. And now what Air Force is doing, there's a lot of quality there, and everybody seems to be moving in the right direction.
Furman was 0-4 in 1-2 goal games last year.
Yeah, no, they're there. They, you know, they're an inch away. And once they turn the corner, that's when the team becomes dangerous because they're just lacking that last 10 minutes of the game confidence. Like, we can do this. We've done this before. So, you know, when somebody steps up and they hold on and win one of these games or come back and win one of these games, that's gonna be a quantum leap, a big step for them.
Last player item of note, Maryland defenseman Mac Pons. Ed Lee reported in the Baltimore Sun this week that Maryland will be playing at least the month of February without him. you know, he's a starting defenseman. You know, whether or not he or Tim Muller draws the top matchup is typically dependent on the athletic profile of the opponent, whether he's a big, strong guy or a small, quick guy. But there's no question that from a veteran standpoint, leadership standpoint, as well as, you know, from a talent standpoint, this is a hit to the Terp defense. And there are lingering questions about what his availability will be throughout the 2017 season.
Yeah, you know, I spoke to John Tillman about it off the record a month or two ago when I heard that Mac was dinged up. You know, good thing for Maryland is you got Tim Muller down below. Bryce Young can play both close or pole. I really liked what I saw from him last year. And then you bring back Matt Neufeld, the long stick, who did not play last year out of Culver. He's a difference maker. He'll make their ground ball game in the middle of the field go. You got Henningsen winning faceoff. So as of right now, it's just a blip, the Ponce not being in the lineup. But if someone else were to go down, that's when things get dicey.
No doubt. So, you know, Quinn, one of the things that happens at this time of the season, once games have started, but, you know, only a small percentage of teams have played, is that folks stop paying attention to the scrimmages. And that, you know, we spent almost the majority of the podcast last week talking about our reaction to some of the scrimmage results that we either seen or heard about. And there was one note, one takeaway that I had from last week that I wanted to share with folks. We had heard that Loyola had not shown a ton of spark in their scrimmage against UMBC 2 weeks ago, and then the takeaway from this past weekend was that at one point in their scrimmage against Richmond, they were up 11-1 on the Spiders. Shows that maybe there was a little bit of fire lit underneath the Greyhounds coming away from that first scrimmage. And we heard something similar about Navy in the way that they struggled against Penn State and then a week later really showed out against Virginia. So that's my trend for the 2017 scrimmage season. It is that coaches have been able to get their team's attention after poor performances in the first scrimmage and turn that into a better performance later on in the week, a week later, a couple weeks later, wherever the case may be. Anything from the scrimmage rumor mill that you heard that you feel like is worth sharing?
Well, that ricochet effect, as you said, you know, the yin and the yang, like good week, bad week, good week, bad week. You know, the student athletes typically want to ride that. They feel too good about themselves coming off a win, and they feel too bad about themselves and then go back to work off a loss. You want to see more consistency, as I said earlier, you know, making that mistake with Jack Rapine on the TV show and how that's how I'm triggered. You know, I don't care about the final score. It's the mistakes I made that stand out. So Loyola snap back. Interesting game on Saturday. We'll talk about it in a second. Penn State, you know, conversely, had been dicing people in scrimmages, and maybe they underperformed a little against Robert Morris. They gave up a lot of goals. They had to yank the goalie. And as you said, Navy, down performance to open things up. They were really wounded and without a lot of their personnel against Penn State in that scrimmage, and then they played well against Carolina. Carolina didn't play well against Navy in the scrimmage, bounced back and absolutely dusted UMBC. So, you know, that back-and-forth tendency is something that coaches and players really have to crack down on. You don't want to be the type of team that relies on that kind of emotion, whether it's you get too high or too low.
You mentioned Loyola, Virginia. We will turn our attention to that game now. As we preview the week ahead, to me, this is the game of the month. I am so fired up for this. You called me a Loyola homer last week, and I will own that, but I also think that there's more to it. So the first element is that there are going to be a lot of people that have access to this game. Really, any single individual in the world that has Twitter is going to be able to watch this game if they are so inclined. The Patriot League has a partnership with Campus Insiders. Campus Insiders has a partnership with Twitter, which will stream this game live in the same type of functionality that all of us were able to watch NFL and PGA events over the course of the last year. And I think that's a really, really nice opportunity for lacrosse to be displayed on a bigger stage, one that I feel like, you know, a lot of people don't realize what the scope of it is, and then it's going to be 1 o'clock on Saturday, and you're going to see, you know, folks who you follow on Twitter that you had no idea even knew what lacrosse was tweeting about it because this technology functionality now is spotlighting the sport. It's a really, really exciting thing for the game, and I'm going to be stationed on my couch on Saturday because even though I badly want to be at the Ridley Athletic Complex, I actually feel like it's important to experience this because it's going to be kind of a one-time opportunity, and I want to just know what it's like from the user's perspective. So, you know, G-Shan is going to be in attendance, and he's going to do a great job, and I'm going to swallow this pill and say, Now, there are other reasons I'm really excited about the Premier League game that's going to be going on at the same time, but I'm equally excited for what's going to be on the field and online surrounding this Loyola Virginia game.
The future is now. I'll be, you know, I spoke to Dave Cottle yesterday, who's handling the analyst role, and he does a terrific job. You'll learn a lot listening to Coach Cottle. But, you know, I hope that the production, represents that's all you can say. You know, sometimes you get these free live feeds and it's garbage. And I'm not sure that's doing anyone favor. So I hope in this case, Loyola does a wonderful job with their in-house productions. I hope that continues here. Because this, as you said, this could be a game changer. This can be a real positive.
Well, in this game in particular, there are so many storylines to watch, and I think that you know, what we see on the field is going to answer a lot of questions. So we've talked about these two teams ad nauseum. There probably isn't there isn't so much to go in depth on. So I'll just ask you this: from a hierarchy standpoint, what is the element, what is the, whether it's a personnel decision or a player performance, what are you most excited to be able to glean from this as a setup and a table setter for the rest of the season?
Well, Loyola Virginia, I got it as a high-scoring game, maybe the total around 25. I think the Hounds have to be favored by a goal and a half, maybe two. I think that Loyola, with Patrick Spencer, we've talked about him, and Romar Dennis and Brian Sherlock, they're going to score. There's no question in my mind that offense is going to be very potent this year. My issues with Loyola are defensively. I don't think they're 100% healthy. I don't think they've looked particularly sharp in that first scrimmage. You got a team bouncing back off of a semifinal appearance. They're probably feeling pretty good about themselves. I worry about that. For Virginia, two things. You know, not only are they changing their offensive system, the way they play the game, which takes time, they're also trying to change the culture. So that's a lot going on at once. And while I think Virginia's going to be very good this year, guys like Ryan Conrad, Zed Williams, and Tanner Bales, Michael Howard, they fit that style of play. Lars Tiffany's got to move slow. And so this will be very interesting. They got good athletes. They got great players. If Loyola's not 100% on defense, an upset would be possible here, depending on faceoffs and goaltending.
That's the way I feel about it. For me, the thing that I'm most interested in personnel-wise is who Virginia utilizes at its first midfield, not just at the start of the game, but at the end of the game as well. And the reason for that is because they're moving Zed Williams to attack, which opens up a spot on that first midfield. You know, there are some presumptive candidates like Ryan Conrad, who we've talked about a fair number of times, but I'm very curious to see how Lars and his staff favor the upperclassmen. There are a lot of guys on this team that have experience and have proven their ability to perform and produce in that position. I'm thinking specifically about guys like AJ Fish. And so while Virginia certainly has two-way midfielders in spades, when it comes time to settled offense, whether it's early in the game just to get your offense moving, or late in the game in crunch time when you need a goal, I'm very curious to see who takes the field there, because I really don't have any idea. And that's why I'm most interested and excited about that aspect of the matchup.
I think that's easy for the new coach to come in, because it's all based on merit. There's no promises made. There's no baggage. There's no history of underperformance prior. So whoever the best 10 are that he has seen from practices and his scrimmages, that's who he's going to put out there. Very simple. You could see some new names. It's a complete unknown, really, from my standpoint.
Well, no, yeah, and I agree with that. And I think that, you know, my point is like, So Ryan Lukovic is a guy that we've heard as being somebody who's going to run out of the box. What does that mean for what Virginia is going to look like in a settled 6-on-6 situation? Is ultimately what I'm asking.
We don't know, and you know, they're going to operate a lot like Brown did last year. I think you'll see Michael Krause, you know, freshman from New Canaan, played against his dad. Andy is one of my favorite players of all time. I think you're going to see the freshman Docs Aiken. I love AJ Fish and Ryan Conrad. Maybe, you know, if you're a young midfielder, watch Ryan Conrad in this game, because he's going to be everywhere. Wings of face-offs, defense, he's going to run. They've got four guys they consider two-way middies. He's one of them, and that really fits to his athletic mold. That kid is an animal, and I can't wait to see him play.
You mentioned the Lions. We want to spotlight Las Vegas Lions each week. Unfortunately, we had to, because of traveling, my travel this time, record a little bit earlier, and the Las Vegas Lions aren't out yet this week. You mentioned that you would expect this to be Loyola favored by a goal and a half or two goals. I would take Virginia if the spread were anything more than Loyola by a half a goal. I expect this to be a one-goal game. If I were going to pick the Greyhounds, it would be a function of home field. But I do think that the Cavaliers are going to keep this close. That being said, when we saw a two or a two-and-a-half goal line out of Hopkins, Virginia, with the Blue Jays being favored, I was all over Navy. So I don't have my feel for this season yet, Quint.
Well, you know, that's guys who do their homework get paid. Guys who don't get paid.
That's a solid dig for
it. You don't have to play every game, Terry. You don't have to play every game. Find the one that you know. Stick to what you know. Again, I don't have a strong feeling about that either in terms of predictions.
Two more games that we want to get to. And so we'll talk about what we think a reasonable line would be. Navy Maryland. We've decried the fact that this, as well as Loyola Hopkins and Hopkins Navy, are early season games. That being said, at least they're being played, which in the new brave new world of conference realignment is the threat. This was a game that was moved to the middle of April last year. I thought Mark Dixon made a really good point on his podcast earlier this week that because it was immediately after the Army game, even though Maryland was coming off of a comeback win, a come-from-behind win over Rutgers on, I believe, the Sunday, two days prior, it was still a little bit more daunting for Navy to have to rebound from that emotional overtime victory, and as a result, they got blottoed by the Terps. Here we are again. Navy coming off of the game. It'll be Maryland's first game. Who's to say who benefits from that with respect to freshness versus the confidence of having one game under your belt? What would you say would be a fair line for this one, Quint?
If you're juiceless, you're useless. And that was Navy last year in that game. Fair line here. I'm leaning on Maryland. I think it's 3.5, 4, maybe even 4.5. I think they roll. I don't know why, but that's just my feeling. I don't think Navy's going to be able to keep up with them offensively.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it were that high. I think that the reason being a relative feeling based on who Maryland was last year, with some exceptions, that they want to score 8, 9, 10 goals, which if you're going to put a line at 4 to 4.5, kind of suggests that you think Navy's only going to be able to put up 5 or 6, which may be reasonable based on the fact they put up 8 against a Hopkins defense that people don't expect to be as good as a Maryland defense. That being said, we talked about Mac Pons. Maryland is starting a new goalie. It looks like it's going to be Dan Morris. And, we'll see whether or not they're able to meet the prowess that's been established for themselves. I would take Navy if it were as high as 4. If it's anything lower than that, I would probably say Maryland. I think that, a 12-8 final with the Terps coming down on top would be really close to what my expectations are.
It'd be very interesting to see how Coach Tillman takes this team in terms of starting the season. Last year they lost two of their first three games, a loss to Yale, a loss to Notre Dame, and the offense was punchless in those two losses. So let's see with some new parts at the midfield. Maryland's midfield inexperience is going to be the big storyline, I think, in the first month of the season. Their attack is a proven commodity. You guys rated them the number one group in the country. That's hard to argue with. Rambo, watching tape of him, I kind of undersold his season last year. He was terrific, both as a Dodger. He learned to pass, 32 assists. Rambo had 32 assists. I would never have guessed that he had that many. He was sensational, and I've always loved Colin Heacock's game. He can do it all. I think he can emerge as first team All American type of candidate. Those two guys together, but midfield question marks for the Terps. Where is this team right now in their development? Looking ahead, we got them on ESPNU or ESPN News. Big game on the 25th, which would be Yale at Maryland. ESPN News. That rivalry has been strong the last couple of years. So looking forward to this week's game against Navy and seeing this team in person later in the month.
I'm excited about that. Just real quick on that ESPN News point. When the schedule came out, there were the common reactions, and certainly I think this year the focal point was on the talent in the booth, given that there was a change there. That being said, I think it was fascinating that there are a couple games being played on ESPN News. To me, that's significant because for a lot of these out-of-the-home venues, whether they be gyms or bars or whatever, the ESPN News is left on these places way more frequently than ESPNU is. And so for the purposes of attracting new fans, I like the idea of someone walking into a place and seeing lacrosse on TV and being like, oh, that looks interesting. I want to know a little bit more about that.
That's a positive perspective because, you know, I didn't look at it that way, Terry, quite honestly. We wanted this game to be played in the evening. I'm lifting back the curtain here, Liv. I hope I don't get smacked for it. But we wanted these teams to move the game to the evening, and they refused because the potential for a frozen evening in empty Bird Stadium. So that they kept it midday, and the window then becomes ESPN News. So there's jockeying going on behind the scenes, and too often these coaches, there's a little bit of selfishness when they don't want to move games for us. This is something that we're going to sit down at the end of the year and go to the coaches early, show them our calendar, show them what we got. And we got to slot great games into good time slots, and everybody's got to be on the same page. We need a czar, and that's one of the things that we continue to try to maximize. We're struggling with it at times. This is a case where the Terps didn't want to move. I get it. Like, you know, February 25th, it could be 20 degrees out. Who wants to sit there at 7 o'clock at night and watch a game? So I can't blame them. It is what it is. And that's part of the challenge of February lacrosse.
All right, Quint. Last game we want to talk about this week is Air Force heading to Denver. Game is set for 3 p.m. Eastern time. Another one of those games where we've got one team with a result under its belt. Certainly we've talked about the Falcons 11-10 victory over Duke a couple times. Meanwhile, Denver will be making its debut. This is a hotly contested series. And I think that, you know, I remember thinking about this game 2 years ago when Air Force was an independent. I'm thinking to myself that when you examined their schedule, you know, there were basically two top 20 matchups that if they were able to secure those victories, they would be able to put together maybe a 10 or 11-0 start, in which case they'd be able to warrant serious at-large consideration. One of those games was obviously against Denver. They weren't able to win, and as a result, you could see, the season became a little bit disappointing as the opportunity to qualify for the NCAA tournament slipped away early on. That being said, I do think that the Falcons pose a really interesting test for Denver's defense, and it's going to be a prime example of the way that I think most of us expect Denver to have to play games this year, which really starts from Trevor Baptiste's ability to win 7 out of 10 possessions and keep the ball away from opponents. This was a 10-9 game last year, and I would be surprised if we saw anything too far away from that. What is your take on a fair line?
I like Denver in this matchup because of one reason and one word, and that is respect. The Pioneers have enormous respect for Air Force. As you said, 10-9 game last year. The series has had some real battles. This is almost like a local rivalry now out in Colorado. Denver, when they got to work this week, there's a tremendous amount of respect for Air Force, and I think you'll see a strong performance for that reason. And for the way they ended last year, Pioneers lost at home to Marquette in their tournament final. Disappointing. They looked flat. They didn't look like themselves. Expected them to bounce back the next week in the NCAA tournament. Again, a loss by one goal to Towson at home. Coming off back-to-back home losses from last year, I think they jump out and erase that taste from their mouth with a bigger win here than most people would guess because of the word respect. And for them wanting to start this season off on a high note.
Quint, we've got a full slate of action this week. There are still a few teams that will make their debut either February 18th or slightly beyond. But this is it, man. The season is here. When you look at the Inside Lacrosse calendar page, you have access to watch every game but one via TV or the web stream. Really, web streams. I don't think there are any TV games this weekend. That being said, you get on your phone, get on your computer, make sure you take in as much lacrosse action as possible. Inside Lacrosse will be on hand for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 of these Division I men's games, as well as a couple of women's games, and maybe a D2 or D3 game mixed in there as well. We will have the Epic Game Day recap going up on Sunday. Check out all of the news analysis and highlights from around the weekend, and check out our podcast on Monday as Dan Aburn and Kyle Devitt react to the weekend's action.
Yeah, from a TV standpoint, we got ESPN3 Saturday, 1 o'clock each, and Don Zimmerman makes his debut as an analyst as Hopkins hosts UMBC, and then my poll comes out on Monday. Hope everybody reads it and comments.
Quint, as always, you're the man. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for listening, folks.
Inside the Cross Podcast.